I'd like to call this meeting of the Development Committee to order. Is there a motion to approve the minutes?
Motion to approve.
Second, all those in favor?
Aye.
Thank you. First presentation, Kayla. Looks like you're up. I'm looking forward to this because I've had a lot of questions about our quiet zones. And so looking forward to the presentation. Thank you.
This is actually going to be a joint presentation with Matthew Myers, City Traffic Engineer. He's going to handle the bulk of that, and then I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the projects that are going on that are closely tied to this quiet zone. So I'll hand it over to Matt.
All right, good evening. This is a fairly high-level discussion on quiet zones that's pertaining, you know, this focus on downtown Bebo and probably close to the Chick Village area. But I'll just kind of go into it. One of the things about the quiet zones and where it's established, this is the federal regulation that talks about and requires train engineers to sound their horns. It overrides our noise ordinance, but it also has the steps for establishing the quiet zone. So this is the law that actually is that everybody focuses on within this process. A couple other things about this rule that's important as well is I get asked about the train horns all the time, and this is what tells the train engineers what they're supposed to hit when they're in the train. And this is also the part where it has an established maximum limit. So it's 110 decibels is the maximum noise that the trains actually have, and it's just really loud, particularly if you're on the train or sitting next to it. For the most part, when you think of a quiet zone or you think about the trains that are coming towards a crossing, good faith effort is they're a quarter of a mile away from an intersection, and that's when they're supposed to be laying on the horns. That's important because when you look at a quiet zone within the law, you look at a minimum distance of a half mile section of the track. So when we look at a quiet zone and we start talking about establishing one, that half mile is the very minimum that you start with as a segmental track. And you can expand it from there. You can make a quiet zone really as long as you want to, but a half mile is the critical. It's the minimum. It's what you got to start with. So whatever falls into that half mile. All right. Out of everything about a quiet zone, this little chart is probably one of the most important. And I'm sorry it's very boring, but it's what it is. So the railroad has an algorithm they use to calculate risk with a train horn. And for any quiet zone or for any section of track, when they calculate it, when the train actually hits the horns, they say that this is the risk threshold for those horns. And it's important because what happened is Florida, many decades ago, went through a quiet zone and they eliminated the horns and they pretty much doubled the number of people that were killed at their crossings. And that history is what's driving everything within the quiet zone. If you keep thinking it's about noise and that kind of thing, you kind of lose focus of what the law was about. It was about safety. And for Federal Rail and for the railroad carriers, they go back to that and say, we are on the horn for the safety. So they calculate what that risk is, and they have a set procedure for it. So right now, if you were to say the downtown, this right up here is their threshold that they say that they have for when they sound the horn. That's just kind of what their acceptable risk. If you turn the horns off, they recalculate that, and that risk threshold goes up. All right? In order to get a quiet zone, you have to improve the safety of the crossings. That's the basic idea. If you can add enough safety measures where it's recalculated and you're below this threshold that's up here, and this threshold is basically the natural safety risk threshold, and that's a number that's calculated for every crossing across the country. If you can get below that, you can establish a quiet zone. The thing about that, though, is
are there numbers or anything like that to correlate with this?
No.
Is the cumulative 100% or decibels or something like that?
No, I'm just kind of using it as illustrative. It's always the natural risk threshold. They have a calculator that you can use, and you can come up with the hard numbers. For us, like for instance, a half mile in downtown would be from pretty much from First Avenue to Fifth Avenue. That's a half mile section, and what they'll do is they'll calculate the risk for each individual intersection, and then they weight that to the traffic volume, and they come up with that number. I don't know, I haven't memorized what this particular number is, but I did want to highlight the fact that this top bar, this national number, it gets recalculated every year. And what happens, you would think that everybody's like us trying to improve safety. This bar can actually go down. And if it goes down below your calculated risk is what the yellow line is, you can lose your quiet zone. Now, we're competing with something like Chicago, Florida, Texas. You know, that may gradually come down, but you are always, if you're in that red, you always have the potential of losing your quiet zone. So if something should happen within your quiet zone and do an investigation, it's a risk that you have to kind of roll on the dice for yourself. And it's important to remember that because at the very minimum, you have to put in the gates and you got to have flashing lights. And for each individual crossing, that's about $250,000 to $300,000 each. If this yellow line, if you can actually add enough safety measures and get down into the blue where you're below the risk with warrants, you're done. You never risk losing a quiet zone. And our outlook as a city has been, instead of taking the risk and worrying about what's in this red area, we've always kind of, you can calculate what that risk is with the horns. And like I said, as you start with the half mile section, but you can grow that. But as you include more and more of those crossings, you just have to recalculate it. And the tool's not hard to use. You can get that hard number. But you can look at that risk with the horn. If you get, if you stay within this blue area, if you're always below that risk with the horns, then we really truly are finished. Whatever we spent money on, it's there forever and ever. So that's a very important concept. The other thing that's important as well is it's weighted by traffic volume. So projects that we do like on First Avenue at Doubletree, on 8th Avenue and 12th Avenue, those three are the highest traffic volumes. If we spend most of our money on that, then we don't necessarily have to spend quite as much money as some of the other crossings like Schuylkill Drive or 6th Avenue or other things. So this is 2nd Avenue. And what we've actually added for that is, this is a 100-foot median. We've added the gates. Of course, it's the two-way traffic, so there's new flashing lights for both directions. But this little access into the parking garage still may require, when we reach out to the railroad and reach back out to the federal railroad, they'll probably look at that and say, okay, that's pretty close. Have you done everything you can to prevent this car from going this way and driving around the gates? That might be the only comment that we may have to actually address. But for the most part, when I say we're adding safety measures, this median is part of that, and as well as the gates and the flashing lights as well. The pedestrian crossing also is something that gets looked at as well. But the short list for safety measures are this. You can, of course, cut a street off. You know, if you close the street at the railroad crossing, that's the ultimate that you can do. Fourth quadrant gates, this is meaning that there's a gate for every lane on the track, for the track itself, for both majors. And the example, we do have one of those, is 3rd Avenue and 3rd Street at the Art Museum. They have a loading dock that sits right on top of the track. And they back a semi into that. So when we were, when we were touching on medians and we were talking about doing things right in front of that loading dock, they just looked at us and said, there's no way we can back a truck trailer down to that loading dock. So we're adding basically four gates that closes off every lane on both sides of the railroad for that major, but it's over $500,000. And there's ongoing maintenance fees with that as well. It's about $14,000 a year that we pay. The one-way street, the reason why it's on there is just because that's, you're not talking about two directions, it's just one gate, you're going over a lane, you're done. And then this last one is just saying that you add medians, that 100 foot is kind of a magic number to the railroad, that if you bring the gate down and you have a median, people are not as likely to serpentine and go around the gates and just drive over the crossing itself. I mentioned the pedestrian crossing, so anything that has a street or an alley within 60 feet, you know, talked about being closed or relocated. You do have to deal with pedestrians. This diagnostic review is a final field check with the railroad, if there's anything there that has to be covered. And then this notice of intent is a public, once you do everything and you've got a plan in place, you're going to construct, you draft a notice of intent that goes out to every interested party, and they have 60 days to comment, and you address whatever comes out of that period, and then you actually you send out a notice of establishment. We have so many things in the downtown area. I don't know if as a city that you that we'll be able to completely just establish a quiet zone, but we do have a few situations right outside of the downtown area that if we just do the safety measures at the railroad crossing and everything is you know, a quarter of a mile on each side of the intersection, if it's to the T, to the regulations, we do have the authority to establish a quiet zone. It's just that in the downtown, sometimes you have the parking garage that's right there on top of the tracks, and you have some other things you got to deal with, and that prevents us probably from just doing that right out. But the federal regulations actually say if we do everything within that and we calculate that risk threshold, and if it's really below what the horns are, we can do that. We go through the notice of intent, 60-day period. If we don't have anything that we can handle, then we can do the establishment, we put up the signs, and we're done. Notify the railroad, and we can establish a quiet zone. This is talked about the fact that you do have to deal with some pedestrian crossings. We do have a few across the tracks in downtown. There's one between 1st Avenue and 2nd Avenue, and there's another pedestrian crossing right there between 2nd and 3rd as well. Before, I've talked about the fact that 79 crossings with streets. This is going from basically Sickle Drive all the way through downtown. When you get to 8th, the railroad tracks split. So Transit goes in front of Bottle Works, the water tower, over to the river. And then UP continues and goes on down to the South Cargill plant. That's what this slide basically speaks to. But I do want to say that, you know, you can't expand that quiet zone. So we've been speaking with Cranick on a few other crossings to the west of the river that could be added to it. As we just talked to him this week about those crossings. And then there's things even down by the South Cargill plant that we can even go beyond what we've been talking about here lately. You know, the focus has always been downtown in the New Bow area. But we have the potential to probably lengthen that just a little bit. It would probably take a couple more years to do that, but it's very feasible. Some of the specific construction projects that we have going on right now, this is going to touch on. This First Avenue by Doubletree, that's just, there's a median with that. We're dealing really with the trail, and relocating the trail and that pedestrian crossing that's right there. You know, it's I wouldn't call it an expensive project. I think the price matches what the scope is, but there's a lot of detail with that. And we've been talking with the railroad in Federal Rail about this alleyway that's right here by Doubletree and U.S. Cellular Center. There's a few things that have to come in here that it's almost one way in. I think it happens to be deal with solid waste, and you got to come right back out. But that's been something we've been dealing with. And also just getting a contract signed by the railroad company. So we've been saying next summer for this project. This one's very, very key. I would say there's probably 20,000 vehicles a day on First Avenue, and that's going to drive that that risk analysis a lot. The other one, of course, is what we have going on right now. We have Third Avenue that's got the quad gates that are being constructed, and that's you know, that's this summer supposed to be finished up. And then also the New Bow, this has medians. It's got relocated an entrance into the parking lot into the church. This is next summer, I believe. This also, I think that we had the pedestrian crossing that was going to be down by the market. That was all part of that, and I think that was just actually awarded as well. But this crossing here actually gets into the fact that this median goes across 6th Street. And this is, you know, it says 15th Avenue, but this is Otis Road, but a lot of people know it as. And with the connection to the South Cargill plant and the tractor trailers that are there, this is a component of how we get tractor trailers through the area. It's very important. haven't done a lot of design on that, we haven't done outreach, but if you build this median right here, you have to do something with the trailers. You gotta put them, tractor trailers, you have to put them somewhere, and this has been the connection here. We've added the signal, we've looked at this as a pedestrian crossing to, you know, the high schools right there as well. But there's not a lot of detail beyond what this picture is just showing. That's right there. What's interesting about this crossing, I was here about 3 months ago, and I was watching it because of other reasons. And those flashing lights came on, and I watched six people run that railroad light right in front of a train. And the train moves so slow, and they didn't even stop. They didn't even bother to look either way. To give a scope of what the impact would really be, we would say from the Stickle Drive, which is the trail connection, all the way down to 8th Avenue, that would be, we would look at that as a segment that should be financed and continue for a quiet zone. That's been probably our highest priority. But I've gotten a lot of calls about this little section right here as well. So this is, you know, bottle works from wintertime going over to the river. And then really, if you just take off of 8th Avenue, you know, track split right there, but just continue on down. They're not colored for any other reason, just so you can see them on the map. But if I was going to say as a quiet zone, that's probably where we get most of our complaints. That's where people look at and say, for quality of life, we've had questions about economic impacts. And I've gone all the way down to Cargill. This is not that far out of the realm of a reasonable thought of making that happen. We've added some dates to this. Some of it's pretty broad because we don't have like the hard construction projects identified, like wrong here on the blue section and the yellow. If you don't know this, 9th Avenue split on the tracks. There's a lane on each side of the tracks, and that's a weird, unusual circumstance, and we don't have a strategy on the table to propose to anybody and how that would actually impact. I would envision there would be a fence along the railroad and really just control what's going across on those tracks. It's just not a crossing, it's just wide open. So that's one thing that's really kind of odd about the whole thing. I think that's everything on the slide deck, and whatever questions you might have.
Thank you. Marty?
Okay, so first question, I may have missed it. So I go to the town of Bellevue quite often, and that whole town is a quiet zone, but about from 500 to 1,000 yards before you get to the town, they just lay on the horn and they're gone. I mean, they lay on it for like 500 yards to let the whole town know we're coming. So before Stickle Drive, that quiet zone starts, will they change their kind of operations of, you know, we're going to lay on the horn for 500 yards until the quiet zone starts and then we're done? I mean, I know it's different, but I'm just saying it, I've experienced it where I'm like, holy God, you know, how long are they going to lay on that horn? And then you realize the whole town is a quiet zone, so it's kind of a warning. So do they do that leading up to it? So that's going to affect everything to the north of Stickle Drive and then everything to the south of Newbo.
So for horn use at a public crossing, this traditional sounding pattern that's right in here, it says come back. Two longs, one short, one long. I wrote that. That's as much details in the law. That's the pattern you're supposed to use. So if at that city they're doing something that sounds kind of odd, I can't speak to that or why they would do that. The other thing to keep in mind, too, and I keep going back to this, everybody says it's a quiet zone, it's about safety. If there's anything the engineer sees, anything, they're going to definitely hit on that. So maybe there's something that's prior to the crossing that they have to do something that's odd. But this pattern is the only thing that I know of that dictates their minimum behavior that they need to do within the train.
Okay.
There may be something else that's going on that the engineers do. But I'm not really aware.
And maybe this is what they do.
Yeah.
It just seems to me like it's forever. And then once they hit the town, you don't hear them again until they, you know. So, can you go back to the First Avenue bike trail slide, please?
That's right there.
I recall one time. So, on the west side of the tracks, right now, there's, on both sides, there's ballards that you go through, and then it lights up, and then the cars stop. Are we going to try that same system on the east side of the tracks when you move the trail from the west side to the east side?
No. We would call that impavement. There's impavement warning lights, and what we're actually going to put in, the pictures closer to what's going to be there, being our normal rapid fire flashers that we do across the entire city. So Ingredient has two pairs, St. Luke's Hospital has one. That's our standard setup. I'm not sure a lot of people know this, but these impavement flashers, they're very difficult to maintain. I would say half the road goes out every 6 months. But the other thing that happens too, it's a multi-lane road, is for the most part, they're not recommended to be put in anymore. And directly related to pedestrian safety, because what happens is people see these flashers, they think one lane kind of stops, the other one doesn't. And the system that we're putting in, is this considered better? Is this safer? The other thing that we get into, because it's right there on top of a railroad crossing, you know, the next level would be like at 42nd Street, where, you know, that looks like a signal. The reason why we didn't use that is because it flashes red, or it goes red. We have these red flashing railroad lights right in front of it. So this is kind of working with the railroad traffic control that we have as well. And we're very confident with the performance of safety for pedestrians when we move it to the system.
So there will be some mechanism there to get cyclists and walkers safely across without just kind of entering at your own risk.
Oh, yeah, the push button activated.
Okay, all right. I knew that we were getting rid of the in-pavement things, but I guess I didn't understand what it was being replaced with, so.
Yeah, it's definitely pedestrian actuated. The bollards, I would say, they work pretty well, but they're definitely at the end of their life, and we're spending more and more time keeping the bollards going.
Sure.
The other thing, too, is that there's no guarantee that people go through the bollards. I think they understand it, but sometimes people cut the corner, and they don't always activate the flashing light. So this is still, you have to go up and hit the button to hit it. It's not like the bollard when you go through it. But they are pedestrian actuated.
But it's not a great corner the way it is now when you're heading north, because you come across, you go over tracks, and you turn left right away.
Yeah, this would be, I would characterize it as being a very natural path. When the trail is located, you'll look at it, you'll hit it, it's your natural path, you go across, hit the button. I feel like it's a lot better. It's a much superior design than what we have right now.
Okay. And then my last thing is, if you can go to the 12th Avenue, the Nubo, 12th Avenue. So right now, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think 6th Street is the truck route. Is that moving to 7th Street?
Yes, and the other thing to keep in mind, there is no truck route south of 8th Avenue. Historically, trucks use 6th Street, and I'm guessing they've done that forever. But there is no established truck route to Cargill. And so if you go onto our website, if you look at the municipal code, 8th Avenue is a truck route. 7th, 8th, and 10th Street from 8th Avenue going north up to 1st Avenue into 380. Those three are established truck routes. But everything to the south of 8th Avenue is not. It's just traditionally they said this is our direct route. And for a trucker to use 7th, they really couldn't, because even on 6th Street, you know, the railroad being as high as it is, for a trucker to sight distance is fine, and you can see over that hump. But when you start doing things like come down 7th Street and you're trying to turn around that high school, notice the gray area, that's an exaggerated illustration, but really we're going to have to look at the turning radius to do something. The 6th Street to 15th Street connection for a tractor trailer, that's an easier movement. I don't know if we can move them anywhere else right now.
No, that was my question. So in the middle of 12th, isn't that showing a median?
Yes.
So if we remain the truck route on 6th, how are they going to get to Cargill?
They would have to move to 7th. That is the intention.
So we're moving all that truck traffic next to Metro High School.
Yes. And what I've said is, this is what we've been showing as an illustration. We haven't done any hard design. We have not made any outreach to anybody like the high school or anybody else about that. And it isn't just the high school, the health center is being built.
I think there's a lot of issues. Very populated down in this area, so I don't think there's a slam dunk, this is an easy answer.
Oh, no.
But to me, it just, when you say, okay, do I go in between two apartment buildings or do I go right next to a high school? It's an easy answer for me, but I don't know. I mean.
Oh, yes, I don't think it's a slam dunk. I definitely think there's a lot more work on our part. Yes, absolutely.
Okay. That's all I had.
Ashley? One of the questions, and Kayla, maybe this comes to you. Since we've been working on this, and this is, you know, we're projecting out to 2020 for some of this work, we've got a lot of development projects in the works. And our developers, my question to you is, are our developers who have come before us, whether it's Richard Solvo, which sits right there on the 8th, or the Banjo Block sits close, have we been communicating with them this time frame, and so they are going, they can have some confidence that the city's moving forward with our planning for these quiet zones?
Absolutely, and to your point, this has come up, and we've shown here kind of those three high-profile projects, the hotel, the Banjo Block, and the Loftus Lumber, just to illustrate how close they are to the rail line. And we have certainly communicated kind of those timelines to the developers. And the other thing I would say is they actually will have a piece in cooperating with us with some of the improvements that we're making. And we've been working with the hotel folks on the 2nd and 3rd Avenue improvement projects that are going on now with location of access and those types of things. And the same will be true when we get into the Banjo Block redevelopment, because that literally is right behind their building. So we're definitely having those direct conversations with those developers about their projects.
And I have, you know, we have friends who come in and stay and family at the DoubleTree, and they love the facility, but they always say, oh, those horns, you know, and we get it. So I'm happy to see that we're really taking a hard look at the First Avenue, and it looks as though that. So I think also that we've been talking about, you know, these quiet zones and what it's going to take, but I think one of the things that the public needs to understand is the amount of money that the city's investing in the arms and the medians and the gate, you know, the gates and the medians and the lights in order to quiet this whole section of rail. Because when you start turning our streets into two-way streets rather than one-way streets, you're doubling the cost, I would assume. Is that correct?
So definitely when we were doing the two-way conversions and we changed the one-way to two-way, we had to change, we had to add something to the railroads because they definitely didn't have lights for that both direction. And to me, the additional cost is certainly the gates. I don't know if the gates themselves, you know, added like 100, like double the cost. We probably in the same scale that we were always going to have to pay pretty close to $250,000 to $300,000 with the two-way conversion. I really believe that's probably true. I think that when we jumped to the quad gates for the one that we did, that was a pretty significant bump in cost, certainly. And we look, you know, when we look at the medians, you know, the medians, I say, were for the quiet zones, but we even added the median at the library to help with pedestrian safety between Green Square and that. And the other thing that the medians do at the railroad crossings, I'm not sure people really understand this concept as a traffic engineer. I love this kind of thing. It manages speed, and we were talking about making it, you know, get the speed back down to 25 miles an hour, which is what's posted in downtown. And with the medians and as well as the bike lanes and the lane widths that we use, we definitely achieved that with the median. So we got some other things out of this besides just the fact that we were required to because of the two-way conversion. So I think there was some added value that we gained out of that as a city.
Thank you very much. Yeah.
So the only question that I have is, you know, it seems like a lot of this is an estimation of moving that needle into the blue zone, into something that then would qualify us not to have the horns blasted. So is there any risk of us making all these changes as costly as they are and then not qualifying for that because the needle has moved?
I don't think so. I think as long as we definitely are below the threshold with the horns, I think once we get below that, I think we're good.
Okay.
And there may be some things the railroad might bring up. I think the two pedestrian crossings, they're nice, they look really well, they're bricklaid, but I think they're gonna say things like, we want that removed for the corridor. And as long as we're okay with doing certain things like that, which I think we would be, I think we'll be fine. I think we'll be able to get the quiet zone.
Because your story earlier about people going around the arms, well, really, if somebody was blasting their horns, they could do that just the same, and people do that. So that still is something that, even though you were saying that as something that maybe was a red zone thing, something to be a little bit concerned about, I think that that's more of a blue kind of zone thing, because people are doing that regardless of whether horns are blasted or not. They estimate how fast the train is going and try and get ahead of it if they can. So you really shouldn't do it.
Yeah, absolutely. Kranich right now, they staff some of their trains with extra people. And I witnessed this week. We were talking about adding gates right there in Green, and they had a train coming across, and people were, the lights were on, and they were running it, and they used a human being to step in front of the cars to get them to stop. They have two places in town, one's on Bowling Street and one's in Green, and they may do it at a couple other places, but they use people to step out in front of the train and make sure nobody's coming across the track. So that culture that we have within the city, we've taught people for the last 40 or 50 years on how to handle our tracks. And that's one of the things that the railroad company, when you speak to them, that's their perspective. And you do have to meet at their level of what it really means to make it crossing safe.
Thank you. Thanks, guys. Updates? Zoning advisory group, Seth?
So the first agenda item I have today is an update on the zoning code itself and also the zoning advisory group, which had their first meeting yesterday. Talk a little bit about how things are going with the city's new zoning ordinance and what we've changed to date. Also just going to talk about the zoning advisory group meeting yesterday, and I'm going to start off with some numbers on kind of what the City Planning Commission has been saying today. And what these blue lines represent is the cumulative number of cases that the City Planning Commission has received from January till June, from 2013 to 2018. And what this green line down here is a cumulative number of cases seen by the City Planning Commission this year. So you can see one of the effects of the zoning code is that there's been a drop off in cases. Specifically, the number of rezoning applications. Last year, we saw 16 rezoning applications in the first 6 months of the year. This year, we've seen 6. And that means one of two things. Either the amount of development citywide is going down, or it means that by correctly zoning more parcels, fewer people are having to go through a 90-day rezoning process to get their project approved. And just for context, the number of major administrative site plan applications, which is an administrative process that was not changed by the code update, that's actually gone up year over year. What I don't have in these numbers is something that would tell you necessarily that the total amount of permitted development has gone up in that time, but at least the number of cases that staff's working on. It's fair to say that the reduction in the amount of public review processes doesn't seem to be correlated to a reduction in the amount of development the staff's reviewing. Similarly, the number of variance applications has gone from about 42, I think, in the first 6 months of last year down to 4 this year. Going after variances was a really big kind of part of why we want, of something we wanted to do within the zoning code, both by removing common situations where people are asking for variances, and also working with the Board of Adjustment to keep a pretty strong line on what the approval criteria for a variance was. In the spring of 2019, in March, we did our first round of updates to the code. Right off the bat, we identified a few typos and errors that we immediately wanted to correct. We also found in landscaping requirements, we found a pretty big error when we were requiring significantly more landscaping along the street edge of development than we really intended. We were basically asking people to screen their properties with landscaping rather than provide landscaping. So we quickly came up with an adjustment to that. And we added in some additional ways where staff could provide adjustments for common site constraints. For example, the city will occasionally require developers to dedicate right-of-way for new development. And we added in an exception where staff can reduce things such as buffer yards or setbacks, things like that, proportionally to make it easier for if we're putting constraint on a site because we need 5 feet of right-of-way for a future road project. And we're anticipating the next round of updates will occur in the fall of 2019. So the Zoning Advisory Group, it's a 5-member panel. We have 3 community members, Grant Norby, Susan Fornash, and Jim Pearsall, and then a representative from both the Board of Adjustment and the City Planning Commission. And really the role of that group is to assist in evaluating performance of the code and help us in prioritizing updates. We had the first meeting yesterday. At that, we basically presented the same information we presented now in terms of talking about what staff has seen in terms of caseload and the amount of cases having to go through public approval processes. We also previewed with them our list of items we're going to work on for the next round of updates. That includes things ranging from some vehicle and home occupation things. We've identified a number of other little typos or inconsistencies that we want to clear up within the code. And we've got a running list of kind of good ideas that staff has come up with that we'll want to get around to when we can or consider implementing within the code. Basically, that's kind of the update on rezone at this point. Our timeline for future action is we're hoping to get together with the Zoning Advisory Group for the next month or so and dive in a little bit deeper into the issues that we've identified. Our hope is to, within the next couple of months, have a public hearing at City Council with the next round of code updates. And when we come back with those, we will be able to tell you how the discussions went with the Zoning Advisory Group on that and have a recommendation from the Planning Commission.
Thank you, Ashley? Okay, Marty? Wow. Okay, well, thank you very much, and we'll look forward to the updates.
That's so thorough.
Thank you, Seth. And so up next is Street Southwest Corridor Action Plan.
Yep. So the next action plan that community development is going to be embarking on is the 6th Street Southwest Corridor. And this will be 6th Street Southwest from 1st Avenue down to Highway 30, as well as identified with an envisioned CR. This is actually the graphic that was shown in the city's comprehensive plan. This is one of a number of corridors that were identified as needing a corridor action plan. The ones we have completed, for example, remember a couple of years ago, we did Mount Vernon Road. Doing the plan is tied with an upcoming Paving for Progress project. Next year, the city's planning on doing pavement rehabilitation and an overlay on 6th Street from Wilson to 33rd Street. And that will include adding wider shoulders for bikes and other users. And then we're planning on coming back and adding sidewalks along that section of the corridor, which should go from actually here further south, or actually Wilson further south to 33rd. I guess we're off the bottom of the map there. But that will add pedestrian connectivity in what's currently a really big gap in the city between Wilson Avenue and 33rd. Corridor action plans focus on land use in the built environment. We take a look at the transportation network and accessibility. So how everyone uses a corridor, obviously the 6th Street currently, pedestrian connectivity is lacking. The proposed project that Public Works is working on will add a couple bus stops or bus pullouts, along with better accommodations for bikes and pedestrians. And we also kind of take a look at other opportunities that might exist along the area, any public spaces, any other thing that the city's working on which might influence that corridor, and come together with a final plan which will include action steps, recommendations and action steps to fill those recommendations. So the workshop for this is scheduled for Wednesday, August 7th at 6 p.m. This will follow the project meeting the Public Works will be doing for the Pay for Progress project at 5 p.m. We're going to be holding this at a time check hall at the City Services Center. And at that time, attendees will have opportunity to take a look at some of the data we've collected on the project, and we'll also work through or ask them a number of questions about kind of strengths and opportunities along the corridor, and we'll use that feedback in moving on to developing the kind of goals and action steps for the plan. We're hoping later in the fall to do an open house where we review the results of the workshop, and then have a final open house presenting the plan either at the end of this fall or early in 2020. And that's the update I have for that.
Thank you, Seth. Marty?
Just a question. So from Wilson Avenue to 33rd, there's quite a bit of difference of uses there. On the east side of 6th Street, it's a lot of residential and apartments and light commercial, like restaurants. West side's kind of heavy commercial, industrial. With the new zoning codes, as things redevelop on the east side, is that going to change the way people can use the east side with this master plan and the rezoning code the way it is now?
I would say, so under the new code, I can tell you that's not an area we spent a lot of time necessarily looking at lot by lot. So what we did was we looked at what the zoning was and then ported you over to the new zone district that was the closest comparison, the closest analog. So in a lot of cases, the names of the zone district changed, but we didn't necessarily change how you were zoned. We might have new rules saying that certain types of development or that certain design standards would apply to everyone across the city that might affect that. But the plan itself is an opportunity to take a closer look at what the zoning is along that corridor. So I guess that's something we haven't really dug into too much, for that answers the question. But that's certainly something we do during these.
Okay, thank you.
So this is probably the presentation I'm most excited about, just because 6th Street is a fairly major throughway in District 5. Especially as some, it basically is the alternative to 380 for commuting through town. So I'm excited to see some of these standards spruce things up a little bit, and hopefully maybe start changing the intersection of 33rd and 6th Street as well. That needs some attention and some new life brought into it. So thank you for this work.
So Seth, there's obviously a lot of sidewalks missing out there. I travel 6th Street to go to work. And so I'm really, number one, happy to see Paving for Progress, because 6th Street is invaluable, to say the least. A lot of work there. So as we do that Paving for Progress work, will we also then be including some sidewalks, necessary sidewalks in that area?
The plan is that...
This is just hard to see, that's why I'm asking.
The plan is that... And actually, I apologize, I don't have a map that extends all the way down to 30, so I can't point to the map necessarily. But the project, which goes from Wilson, which is here, all the way down to 33rd Avenue, so the intersection with the Casey's and the McDonald's and the Taco Bell, that will get repaved next year. And I believe the plan is to reconfigure the lanes to have a center turn lane and a shoulder. Which will immediately help things a lot, because right now it's just a gravel shoulder and that doesn't work for anyone who's on a bike or walking. And the plan is in 2021 to come back and do sidewalks on the outside of the street down that entire length. And I believe that that'll also include a pedestrian crossing, I think, in the vicinity of, is that Westgate Apartments? Down there. similar to what Matt was talking about earlier, the push button activated pedestrian crossing, because there is a long gap without any type of controlled intersection. And it'll also include a couple places where they're planning pullouts for buses and an enhanced bus stop, because a lot of places on that corridor, people are riding the bus to work or to those apartments, and the bus is dropping off on gravel. So that'll be a major improvement.
I often see people walking on gravel.
Yeah.
And so I'm glad that we're going to go back and add sidewalks in that area. I apologize, this was just a little difficult to
see.
No, okay, great. Well, and thank you so much for all your work. We're looking forward to having this done and much needed. So, yeah, sure.
And to your point, Councilor Poe, I really, in my vision for this work, at the juncture of Wilson and 6th Street, I want us to be setting the tone to connect with the pedestrian master plan that was not funded this year. That intersection in particular, all along Wilson, there are always an abundance of people on foot, and there are no sidewalks there that connect, and yet, so people are walking in the street or they're walking on those high angle. So we need to get ahead of that and make that an important aspect of this, so that we can set the tone and hopefully connect a sidewalk all the way down Wilson into our really wonderful recreation amenities. So, thank you.
Check Village
Renewable
Area Action Plan.
Okay, good afternoon. I'll give you an update, quick update on Check Village Renewable Area Action Plan, activities to date, and then what's going to be happening in, I think, an hour and a half, and a little bit of a sneak peek for the future then. So, again, just a reminder of the area. Boundary is close to the SMID boundary for the Check Village Renewable Area. Again, we do have an advisory group along with the public, and the feedback they give, the advisory group is really important because these are really your, typically your strongest group of stakeholders. So we have the entities listed there. And then a reminder of the plan focus, so we're going to touch on connectivity, land use, street safe character, and placemaking. And then depending on what side of the river you're on or a specific intersection, there might be something a little bit different. So we've highlighted some things that I think most people know, Smokestack Bridge, new 8th Avenue Bridge. Well, with the streetscapes, that also we'll touch on, and with placemaking on gateways, tonight, tomorrow, and Friday, you'll see a board where we're asking people to give some feedback on the 16th Avenue gateway. So what we've done today, so we had an internal kickoff with staff in May. We always do these, but these are good to make sure that whether it's done in-house or with a consultant, that we have all the information that we need, projects that are going on, any issues that staff is aware of, and then to really get to people that work, live, play in the area, we ask, go through and ask them, you'll see it later, a SWOT analysis, strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, challenges, and then we did a great geographic mapping exercise. So this is June 5th. We had over 50 people, and the map on the right I'll touch on in, I think, one other slide here. And so basically those were individual tables. They marked up a map of things that they would want to see. So I just wanted to pull out some things that the attendees noted. So for strengths, historic buildings, walkable, arts and cultural reputation, lots of land for infill and expansion. And then some weaknesses of the area that they identified: lack of shuttle or transit service, lack of cultural curation, and scale context of new development. And then for opportunities, some things that were brought up: trolley loop, access to the river, city-owned property open for development, and then well-designed architecture. And then looking to the future and what are some things that might be challenges, finding developers willing to go small, lack of funding, rent and housing costs, and limited hours and days for retailers. So that map I showed before, I made it a little bit bigger. But these are some things that I'll call out that were on that map. So really the focus for this table was housing and public amenities. So some things that they brought up, trails, a playground, a boutique hotel, unique bridge lighting, lot 44 development. So after we have flood control in place, what do we do with the area that's left? For the check build side, a year-round roundhouse. And then right in this area, so around the Greenway Park, they brought up housing and kind of a mix of housing that would border the park area, as well as over in Sinclair. There will be some land left over, again, after flood control, after that use. So that was something that this table brought up. So where are we going? Today, tomorrow, and Friday, and so this is a little bit different, but this is a structured event, so at 6 p.m. we'll have a presentation of different maps. We'll have 4 to 6 maps that the consultants have been working on starting this morning. And they'll do a presentation to the attendees, do a little Q&A, and then ask them to identify what they like and what they don't like on the map. The next day, attendees from Wednesday will see changes based either on their input or another attendee's input. And so the concepts will start to be refined, and then that number of concepts will start shrinking. And then the third day is really that culmination of the last 2 days of input, and you'll also start to see some of the action steps identified at the end of this third day as well. And again, 6 to 8 p.m. at the Czech Museum. And then we do have, in the August or September time period, we're gonna have another open house. This will be our traditional open house. Come whenever you want during a set time period, and we're gonna just kind of give that last touch point with the public on here's the draft goals and action steps that are gonna go to City Council, which we anticipate in November or December of this year. So with that, I'd answer any questions.
Great, thank you so much. Ashley? Okay, Marty? I attended the first meeting, and along with Councilwoman Van Arty, I saw you there as well. And I was pleased with the number of attendees. I thought that it was great. I'm really happy to see this analysis that includes opportunities with the trolley loop. During the holiday season, the Czech Village in particular would get a trolley, and they'd run the trolley from Czech Village down to Nouveau, and then just kind of a circle. And so in my mind, I'm imagining how we could take a trolley or some kind of transportation that was fun and funky and people would want to get on just to go ride and go from, you know, Czech Village, Nouveau, go through the downtown, back over on First Street West, and just make that big loop. And so, you know, I got this strong vision of how that might help with the connectivity between our downtown, our west side of Cedar Rapids, at Cedar Rapids, Kingston Village area, the Czech Village area, Nouveau, and kind of tie it all together, like in a big, big bow. So I really do like the idea of a trolley loop and extending it beyond the Nouveau Czech Village area, but also into the downtown and certainly Kingston Village and west. Also access to the river. We were on a bike ride on Saturday, and we stopped, and there were conversations taking place about the kayaking area and the possibilities for kayaking along the river and how we could access the river. So I know that touch point is right in that area, and you know what we do with that and how we can make that an amenity. All good steps, so I'm real excited to see where else these visionaries go with the plan, so I'm excited about it. Thank you, Adam.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Good job. Next up, Lauren. Hi. How are you this afternoon?
Good. How are you guys?
Good. Historic Rehabilitation Program.
So just wanted to provide an update on the historic rehab program and how it's going. Just a little background, the program was established in August of 2016 to replace the old paint rebate program, which was specifically for painting homes in the local historic district. This newer program provides funding for a whole host of exterior rehabilitation projects for both homes in the historic districts, local historic district, and for local landmarks. And then more recently, in October of 2018, council adopted some changes to this program to hopefully make it more accessible and increase the number of applicants. And just quickly to review kind of some of those changes, kind of the biggest one was we eliminated the loan portion of the program, and now we offer kind of two tiers of grants based off of the applicant's income. We also allow commercial properties to apply for the program in addition to residential. And we changed some eligibility for re-roofing that made it easier for people to apply, and clarified funding prioritization, and also allow for new construction in the local district. So for FY20, the program had budgeted $50,000, and I'm happy to say we've already committed about $40,886 towards projects in the local historic district, so that's really exciting. I've definitely seen an increase in applications after our changes in October, so I'm really excited about that. We have about $9,000 left, and that will be funded in a first-come, first-served basis because our deadline was May 31st. So I've been communicating with people who didn't make the deadline but still were working on applications and communicating with them that we have some additional funding left over. We also have about $34,000 extra from both repaid loans in the program, because this program did used to be a loan program, so we should have some additional funds from that. And then also kind of some rollover funds from FY19. So we have a good chunk of change to still give out, and that's exciting because I'm still talking with people who want to do projects. So again, we'll continue to fund projects this fiscal year on a first-come, first-served basis. And then just wanted to include some kind of completed projects just so you can see the work of this funding. This was a painting project on 2nd Ave. It's really cool to see the before and after and how that paint makes it look really cool. There's another one on Ridgewood Terrace. This one actually received an award from the Friends of Historic Preservation, their preservation showcase, specifically because they kind of made this front staircase kind of more historic for that neighborhood, and so they gave this person an award. And then this last one is another painting project on Park Avenue, and this is another one that received an award just for how well they used paint colors in this project. So that's all I have for an update, but I'm happy to answer questions.
Thank you. Marty?
I have nothing.
Yasha?
So when we started the fiscal year for this program, were we soliciting people, or were we just waiting for them to come to us?
Yeah, so back in March or April, we sent out a newsletter to the local historic district, which had kind of a number of things to educate them about fixing up their homes, but one of the pieces of it talked about how the program has been changed and telling them when the deadline was and that kind of thing. We also held a local district open house, that was another opportunity to educate people about the changes to the program.
So it was sent out to individual homeowners that lived in?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then was there anybody, do we have any stories or any narratives where somebody maybe was on nuisance property or something like that where they were struggling to, because some of these houses, I mean, they looked like they went from good to great.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering if we have any stories or any notion of anybody who was really a dilapidated property that we're not bringing life back into.
Yeah, you know, I'm not familiar. I know kind of our applicants range in the income brackets. We almost all of the ones we had for FY20 were in the lower income bracket. I'm not sure if they were nuisance properties or not, but I definitely have seen like the investment that's been put into this property has definitely improved it. But I'm not sure if you know if they've had a history of nuisance in the past or how this program has impacted that.
Be good to track that just to see, because I think the difference between that loan and the grant, right,
mm-hmm.
has really been going to start equalizing this for people,
yeah.
which is one of the most significantly positive transformations of it,
mm-hmm.
Is that you don't have to have that money to be able to do your repairs. We're helping you do that first. So, yeah. Anyway, thank you for your presentation.
Lauren, just a couple questions. So with the remaining money, how are we getting information out that there is some remaining money that people can take advantage of?
So the kind of first step I did was reach out to all the people that I kind of had on my radar as people that I thought were putting together applications but didn't end up submitting something at the May 31st deadline. So I've been communicating with them, but I think the next step will be more kind of marketing of the program. So we did post on Nextdoor the last kind of funding cycle, so I'll probably do that again and then probably look into other ways that we can reach out to them.
And how is the Historic Preservation Commission engaged in this project?
So we present to them on each project that we fund through this program. At the May 31st deadline, if we have more applications than we have funding for, then they would be the body that we go to help kind of prioritize funding. In this case, we didn't have over the amount we had funding for, but we keep them in the loop on all the projects that we fund, and they're obviously all really excited about that.
Good, and congratulations to Friends of Cedar Rapids Historic Preservation for putting out some awards. I think that's pretty
Yeah.
And it brings people to their showcase as well, so I like that. What would you say the percentage is? Have we gotten any commercial properties that have taken advantage of this at this point, or not?
No, they've all been homes in the historic district so far.
Okay. All right, good. Well, thank you very much for your presentation. Keep up the good work. Great program. Love it. Okay, city team, public comment, unless Brian Morelli wants to say anything else. Anybody else from that? We'll read about it later. Future discussion items, Marty, do you have anything you'd like to throw out there? Yes?
The only thing that I want to bring up is I'd like to have a more intentional conversation about the use of the right-of-way between the sidewalk and the street, what we can use that for. I've had some neighbors that have solicited me for using that for not only plants, but also, I mean, these are just like everyday plants, but also for like vegetable gardens, and I just want to take a look at that and see where it might be appropriate to do that. I've seen some really great examples in the city. Like to see if that's a good fit for some of our zones here.
Mm-hmm. To that point, I've kind of noticed along a particular drive where people have planted in basically our right of way, and then we come in and we do a street, and then it gets all torn up, and that makes me feel bad because it's beautiful usually. I'd be open to having that discussion too. So. I at this point don't have anything further, and. Thank you, city team, as always. You guys do a great job, and we appreciate it. And
motion to adjourn.
Is there a second?
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Hey, Bill.
All right. Yes, sir.